Remind me not to let Jesus be in charge of the guest list for our future weddings, right? That guy will let anyone in. Or would he? This gospel is really weird. Let's just admit that right up. It bedevils scholars and pastors alike every time it shows up because it has a bunch of stuff going on. So what I want to do is unpack the action a little bit, then expand the context, and hopefully we can start to see what Jesus' point is. Then we can figure out what it's trying to tell us. Sound good? I hope so, because that's what I prepared. So what's going on in this parable? All right, Jesus introduces us to a king whose son is getting married, which is great, right? Who doesn't love a marriage and a wedding? And he invites people to come to the banquet. But when the day arrives, nobody shows up. So he sends out some slaves to check on the people, but they refuse to come. So the king sends out a second group of slaves to guilt them into coming, I think. And what happens when this second set of slaves goes out, right? They invite the guests who made light of it, it says, to make some lame excuses to take back to the king. And then the rest, they beat the slaves and kill them. Now, this should sound familiar to you, right? Jesus has used this idea before in other parables. A sending of slaves and having them beaten and killed. So how does the king respond to their slights? Well, he blows his fuse, has all those guests that he invited killed, and on top of it, burns their city to the ground. That's his response. Right? Now, does this sound rational? Right? Does it sound good? No, of course not. It sounds horrible. Right? Sounds vindictive and nasty. Now, remember what Judaism teaches about justice. So remember, Jesus is a Jew, right? What Judaism teaches about justice, that we limit our response. We don't escalate violence. We don't trade violence for even greater violence, right? So in other words, we shouldn't burn a city. Like, that's not how we do it. So we're only halfway through the parable, and it still seems weird, right? The king is not the picture of love or justice. So then, halfway through, the story takes this turn in a totally unpredictable direction. Right? The king wants this wedding to go on, but rather than, you know, have no guests at the party and just have his son get married just with the few people that are there, forced to be there, the slaves, right? He sends the slaves out to go round up some more people, right? Imagine the king barking that order. It doesn't matter who it is, just find some people. We've got all this food, right? There must be dancing. It's absurd. So the slaves go out and they round up a bunch of people from off the street. But apparently not from the city, which, remember, was burned down. Or maybe they are from that city and they have no other place to go. They have no homes, right? May as well go, right? Or maybe they're all, that guy's crazy. I'm not saying no to him. Anyway, they filled the wedding hall, right? Both good and bad, it says. Now, there's something in Jesus' day about what we're supposed to wear to weddings, right? And it's a very prescribed garment here, right? It's a wedding gown that they're all wearing. So it's not so much don't upstage the bride, which is our modern idea, right? But it's more like minimize the evil thoughts, like cover all the skin. Right? So everyone covers up with these wedding gowns, which may have also been supplied by the father of the groom. So here they are. The place is full. We're all ready to go. And the king sees one of these guests. We don't know whether he's good or bad. But he's sitting there in his street clothes. So the king singles him out and asks how he got into this room. Like, how did he get in here dressed like that? And the man doesn't respond. No words. So what does the king do? Have the man bound and thrown into the land of misery, right? Like the place near the sewage treatment plant or downwind from the coal-fired cement plant where people get cancer at disturbing rates, but the rent is cheap, right? That's where he throws him. And that's the parable. That's where it ends. Woohoo! Right? So let's dig around a little bit to make that make a little more sense, I think. Jesus tells this parable after that parable we heard last week. That's the one with the landowner and the vineyard, right? And the one in which he also had some pretty extreme violence and strained our ability to see anything about the kingdom of God in it. Like this, it was weird, right? And what I said last week was it seemed less like a picture of the kingdom of heaven and a lot more like the kingdom of earth, right? It seems more like Jesus putting pressure on the leadership's description of a God than an allegory about God or about Jesus' crucifixion. I draw your attention again to that phrase Jesus uses right in that first line in the gospel. He says, compare, right? He doesn't say, this is the kingdom. Compare the kingdom to what I'm about to tell you. Compare it to a king who invites a whole bunch of people to his son's wedding and none of them want to come. He tries to compel them to come and they don't. So he has them killed and their city destroyed. Compare it to a king who thinks he can replace those guests with total strangers. And then when that doesn't go right, he flips out again. Compare it to a king who keeps resorting to violence to get his way. Right? If there's any question we should be asking about this weird wedding, it's this. Why doesn't the king have any friends? Why doesn't he have any friends? Why doesn't anyone want to support him? Why doesn't anyone want to support his son? We could spend all of our time trying to shoehorn the story into that box that some would favor it. Like, God is the king, and how fantastic it is that he calls all sorts of people to his wedding, and that's a great reading, and I'm fine with that. But just don't do that today. Right? This king has no one. Besides, he's a slave owner and a murderer. Doesn't sound like a good king. Now, the one character I'd rather we draw our attention to is that one who gets thrown out by the docks, right? Like the one who wasn't dressed for the occasion. What if we're looking at him all wrong? Jesus tells us what he's not wearing, not what he is. Maybe the problem is that he's a sharp-dressed man, right? He looks good. And the other guests might be tempted by this rule breaker, that they'll all come running just as fast as they can, right? He broke this rule. What else will he break? Sabbath law, perhaps? Hearts? Remember, we compare this vision of an isolated and murderous king to a God who is generous and full of compassion. So what if we see this wedding guest not as a bad guy, but as one standing up to the vile depiction of God as ruthless and tyrannical? What if we see in the guest in this picture not only of Christ, but of the one who stands up to injustice and brutality as Christ? And what if it makes him dangerous to the dishonorable? What if that makes him attractive to these other guests, to those who live under the tyranny of a genocidal dictator? We can imagine the Pharisees might have a problem with that. The only way that the Pharisees saw this particular parable as being bad enough to try and get him arrested, because that's what happens next. This is the parable that sets them off. The only way that happens is if they felt that threatened by it, by what Jesus is teaching or saying. He doesn't call them stupid or offer some deep heresy, though it is kind of troubling. So it wasn't personal to them, right? The very threat Jesus represented to the Pharisees, he represented to all modern kings and imperialists. Jesus breaks rules and threatens the social order. But he doesn't do it because he's an anarchist or because rules are bad. He loves rules. He does it for love. And his message of love, of a generous, merciful God, of a kingdom we pull to us, of a chance at freedom from the grip of oppression, that message is like light to the moth. It's the water for the dehydrated and the shade for the sunstroked, right? This is the love for the unloved, freedom for the shackled, and hope for the suicidal. Jesus shows us that God doesn't resort to violence and isn't murderous. God is merciful. This is a teaching the Pharisees are confounded by, but the followers rejoice over. For unlike the landowner who only forgives the slave that one time in the parable a few weeks ago, our God shows mercy 77 times, right? Those who know Jesus know the positive, which compares with this negative, the hope with this despair, the mercy with this violence, the freedom with this oppression, right? And we know that God doesn't have an exclusive guest list or destroy cities when things don't go God's way. Not like that. The diversity of God's banquet comes from intention, not desperation. It comes from invitation, not compulsion. And we know more than anything else that God is more than willing to forgive our poor fashion choices. Because we can't all look sharp,